Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Those who haven't yet found a seat, there are a couple down front here. I think I've just turned my mobile phone off, so I think I'm okay to ask the rest of you to turn your mobile phones off. My name's Les Rowe, for those of you who've not met me. I'm Vice President of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and it's a great pleasure to be able to welcome you all here this evening. A lot of new faces, and I hope this means that we'll see a lot of you back here for future events. Tonight, we have two very distinguished speakers talking about an issue of absolutely crucial importance to Australia and to the countries of our region. Our two speakers, one speaker and a commentator. Our first speaker is Professor Gilbert Rosman from Princeton University, who will speak for half an hour on the subject China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present and Future. And he will then be followed by Professor Cha Ching-Hua, who is a professor and associate dean of the School of International Studies at Beijing University, who will give a commentary on Professor Rosman's address. At the conclusion of that, we will have an opportunity for questions, and I hope that I have no doubt that we'll have a lively debate once our speakers have presented. I would like to thank, before we get underway, I'd like to thank Deakin University and Fulbright organisation for making our two speakers available. You're all aware, I think, that Deakin and Fulbright are organising a symposium at the Sofitel Hotel, which has been going on for a couple of days, and particularly today, and is continuing tomorrow, and I've been asked to invite all of you to attend the session tomorrow, which will take place at the Sofitel Melbourne Ballroom, 25 Collins Street. There are plenty of places available, and registration will not be necessary for tomorrow's session. Now, let's proceed to I'll proceed to give a little bit more introduction to Professor Rosman. He's the Musgrave Professor of Sociology at Princeton University, where he's studied rapidly changing Asian societies for more than four decades. He's a research associate at Korea University and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. His subject, as I mentioned earlier, is China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present and Future, a subject of enormous importance to us, and particularly over the last week, as we've watched share markets do whatever they've done. China has always been at the back of the thinking, I think, of many Australians over this last week or so. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Professor Rosman to speak to us. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here, and I'm delighted that I'll have Professor Cha Ching-Hua afterwards to give a commentary so we can make this into a kind of a dialogue. My views may be controversial and also more pessimistic than his, and I think that kind of exchange is likely to be very useful. I'm going to argue the case that there is a grand strategy in China, not some secret plot to clearly accomplish a particular end, but something that has a long-term perspective, that is built around a clear set of objectives, that is consistent with the hierarchical and deliberate nature of the Chinese communist leadership, that is a response to the environment that Chinese leaders have seen, including the collapse of the Soviet Union and the lessons drawn from their failure to have an appropriate strategy, including perceptions of the United States and what they regard as U.S. Goals and strategy. And I'm also going to argue that this is rooted well into the past. So let me start with the past perspective and move forward with an emphasis on the present, by which I mean primarily 2009 to the present, and then some brief comments about where I think the future is heading. With regard to the past, China long had a view under the Confucian worldview that the government was supposed to think in broad terms about the relationship between history and the present, about the relationship between China and its neighbors, all under heaven was a concept, kind of a world order about the particular identity of the state and particularly of this Chinese civilization. And so this, in my mind, made it much easier to move into the contemporary era with long-term planning. However, the disjuncture between the all-encompassing Confucian worldview and the world that China entered, the balance of power elements and the weakness of China relative to other powers made that a difficult adjustment of the second half of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century seemed like a period where it was difficult to come up with a plan, a consistency, a hierarchy of support for some kind of strategy. And so when China was reborn as the People's Republic of China, there was, of course, the precedent of the Soviet Union and communist ideology and the importance of long-term thinking about establishing a socialist and then a communist state. So this gave rise to a good deal of strategizing, although there were frequent adjustments in that, differences among the leadership, differences in how to interpret the international environment, and even though there was a lot of emphasis on thinking about how to move China ahead, it really became an entirely different environment in the 1970s when China became enamored of the idea of a strategic triangle with the United States and the Soviet Union, and then the modernization strategy with reform and opening, and then the goal of creating equidistance between the United States and the Soviet Union from 1982. And there, I see an emergence of a new kind of planning about how to adjust to a world where there would be globalization, shared modernization, and there would also be an intense competition with China trying to achieve comprehensive national power. And so I think China targeted particular countries and eventually regions in terms of how could it increase its power and particularly respond to U.S. power and U.S. hegemonism, the term which is sort of an outgrowth of imperialism, which was still very popular in Chinese writings about the world order in the 1980s. And so we get a sense of trying to find a strategy that will maximize Chinese power so that economically it could benefit entirely from the transformation of the world economic order, and strategically it could prevent other countries, such as Japan, from gaining regional leadership and at the same time gradually weaken the United States and gain more power. This is not so unusual. Many countries would have that kind of thinking. It's typical of a rising power. But I think we've underestimated the degree to which there was long-term and often secretive planning about how to do this. And there were sometimes quite different voices expressed within the academic community and policy community. And so there was often a kind of duality of message. So if you read what's written for one audience, you get one story, and you read for another audience, it's quite a different story. Internal circulation for a long time gave a quite different impression than open sources in China, and people with writing in English, internationally oriented, often created a more optimistic outlook than others writing with a different perspective. Well, with the collapse of the communist bloc, the end of the Cold War, the condemnation of the Gorbachev period, Gorbachev seen as a traitor to socialism and to the Soviet Union, I think that the priority of long-term strategic thinking picked up. And one can trace it over the years during this period. And part of it was to build better relations with all of the great powers, to have cooperation as the emphasis, but at the same time try to figure out how to use divisions among these powers and how to weaken these powers in particular areas, particularly with the sense of China being isolated after June 4th, 1989, and China struggling to solidify its own national identity with many domestic challenges in these years. So I see the past leading towards a pattern of growing clarity about a strategic direction for China, and the first major target in the 1990s was Russia, and China essentially got Russia right. They figured out what Russia's identity problems were, what the tensions were in United States-Russian relations, and they moved from a situation where Chinese-Russian relations looked very problematic in 91 to one where there became a virtual alliance. The term is not used, but in a number of cases, that relationship has moved close to that direction. And Russia has been the strategic partner that's been most advantageous for China's long-term goals. And I think the way they've handled Russia, a tremendous amount of censorship, sensitive handling of particular kinds of issues, trying to avoid the sorts of problems that occurred in the Sino-Soviet dispute, managing Central Asia rather effectively despite great Russian nervousness, that has been an effective strategy. Now, there are new problems that have emerged, and there are different differences that I could talk about, but I think that was their first target. I think the other targets over the last 10 or more years have centered on building strength within the Asian region and creating a patterns of multilateralism, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization for Central Asia, ASEAN plus three for Southeast Asia, the six-party talks for Northeast Asia, where China could manage relations with another great power, at least one, and also begin to steer the region in a direction where China would gain increasing leadership. But where that would go was still rather problematic. A weakened China was biding its time, was hesitant to show what its true strategic objectives were, and was emphasizing with each country during most of this time that the cooperation prevailed over competition. So this was the pass where we didn't understand Chinese strategic thinking, I think, very well. We didn't do a very good job of putting the pieces together, but there were a lot of clues about this direction. But once you get to 2009-2010, you have to assess what were the responses to particular problems. Were they responses that were ad hoc due to new situations that China faced, or were they responses deeply imprinted in the strategic thinking that had been emerging earlier? And was there some grand strategy that would underline what was happening. And so I've been looking at the Chinese debates about various problems, beginning with the six-party talks in North Korea. And I argue that the sort of the shocks in Chinese behavior in 2010 were built in to the longer-range thinking. They were tied into a grand strategy that maybe many of the academics who were most familiar with weren't advocating, but that was more consistent with the national identity and the overall thinking of those with the most importance in strategic policy making. So let's look specifically at one test case, which I think is particularly important, the Korean Peninsula. China had a supportive South Korean public opinion. They had a leadership in South Korea that was eager to distance itself from the United States under President Nomu-hun and was trying to build up more relations with China. It was invited by the United States to be the leader in the six-party talks and to play a vital role with increasing cooperation from the United States, particularly after 2006, in how to deal with this terrible problem of what happens with North Korea. And then in 2008, at the end of the year, before Obama becomes president, North Korea pulls out of this whole process, rejects the agreement that had been worked out in the six-party talks and becomes belligerent. A new nuclear test, threats against South Korea and others. And what was China's reaction? Well, already it had signaled that it wasn't very interested in building trust with South Korea. The public opinion in South Korea, even before the presidential election that changed the direction of South Korea, became very suspicious of China because of what was said about history. And really, there wasn't much effort to overcome this, to reassure the South Koreans. Then a president was elected in South Korea who, I think many would argue, had a more strategic outlook on how to deal with North Korea rather than the short-term sort of divisive approach of the previous South Korean president. But regardless of how you interpret that, China's response to this new conservative president was very negative, although some of it on the surface, that's not always shown. And then North Korea turned its belligerence directly against to attacks on South Korea. And the Chinese response has really been to deflect the criticisms of North Korea. And overwhelmingly in Chinese publications, which I've immersed myself in the last year, and maybe I don't have a fully representative sample, but I think I've got the bulk of what kinds of things have been written in Chinese. Overwhelmingly the articles and coverage has been the fault was the United States and South Korea. We are treating North Korea unfairly. All we have to do is give in to North Korea's major demands, normalized relations, and the nuclear question will be solved. Experts around the world don't believe that at all. North Korea's objectives are far more serious than the Chinese have let on in their articles. And so this decision to attack the U.S.-South Korean alliance, to argue that North Korea has to be treated in a way where it gets much of what it wants, to fail to criticize North Korea for its attacks, I think is a decisive moment that shows a deeper strategy about China gaining dominance on the Korean Peninsula, South Korea and North Korea split, giving China an opportunity to do that, and shoving the United States out as a secondary force, that it has increasingly the economic leverage over South Korea, and it's attacking South Korea for its arrogance, its historical thinking, and so on. So that's one example. Another example is Japan. Now here we see the most obvious case of demonizing Japan in the 1990s, as early as the late 1980s, saying Japan has no right to be to gain political leadership or be a political power in Asia. Japan was aspiring to be so at the time. And of course, when history issues came up, much of them, often because of Japan's revisionist provocations, which China and Koreans and others rightly resisted, China would often combine the revisionists with the realist side of Japan in their attacks. But really, there was nothing to predict what happened, I think, in 2009 to Japan, in 2010. Sure, there was resistance in 2005 on a pretty large scale, but and then the Chinese approach in 2006, even when Japan had its most revisionist prime minister, they essentially said, we want to improve relations. And for a series of meetings, they kept saying, this is a thaw, this is the springtime, this is improvement. And I don't think Japan did anything to offend China in a serious way after that. But in 2009, the writings, I find, towards Japan became decidedly more negative, going well beyond the history issue, dealing with the Taiwan issue more. And in 2010, an incident where the recorded videos show a Chinese fishing boat ramming a Japanese Coast Guard cutter. That incident in China was interpreted as Japanese aggression, and it was blown way out of proportion. The whole atmosphere of improving relations was already in great trouble, and it began. And the pressure increasingly was, it's not about Yasukuni Shrine, it's not about history so much, although everything was linked to history. It's really about Japanese rejection of cooperation towards regionalism, the Japanese-U.S. alliance as trying to contain China, a territorial issue which Japan had no interest in blowing up, became a symbol and an opportunity for China to become much more assertive about Japan. Southeast Asia, we see the South China Sea become a big issue. And the great goodwill and soft power that China had been able to accumulate over the previous decade plus, and to create an atmosphere where there was a good deal of trust, was dissipated very quickly with aggressive moves and claims and accusations, which had been anticipated earlier, about U.S. hegemonism, U.S. no right to interfere, attacks on the Obama administration for trying to re-enter Asia as if the U.S. had somehow left Asia, that U.S. has no right. And the bulk of the readings I saw on regionalism rejected the previous Chinese approach, emphasizing Japan-U.S. cooperation as Japan-China cooperation as the basis, instead emphasizing a much more Sino-centric approach where China would take a much more leading role. So a lot of goodwill was lost in this period, and the way it was framed in most of the writings really suggested there was a deeper view. So what was going on? Well, it wasn't because China was provoked, because Hatoyama, the leader under whom this tension mounted, was the most pro-China leader that Japan had in many decades, and with the East Asian community, and the United States was quite nervous about things he was doing. Obama came in with a real emphasis on how to improve relations with China, and while the term G2 is repudiated on all sides, it really was. How can the United States and China together sit down and deal with the financial crisis, climate change, security problems, North Korea, which is a big priority for the Obama administration in terms of its strategic thinking? How can it deal with these issues? And I think they got the response that China saw the U.S. as weak, was not satisfied, and the world financial crisis had intervened. But I really think it was something deeper, a deeper strategy about the Korean Peninsula, about how to deal with the Taiwan situation, about how to marginalize the United States in Southeast Asia, how to find more divisions in the United States and its allies, including Australia. And so there was this real sense that there was some deeper purpose, plan, and that's what I regard then as the primary strategic thinking in 2010. Now, much of this backfired. China's reputation, its image, was in trouble by the end of the year. It had alienated countries on all sides. There was even a little nervousness about Russia resetting relations with the United States. So here's a country that had no real close partners, and it was, but it also had overreached, with many saying this is the time where China can be more assertive. And so there was backtracking, and it was important for the leadership to have a successful summit in January 2011. And even though it really wasn't a very successful summit, there was a lot of tension in the run-up to the summit on dealing with issues, particularly North Korea. And at the last minute, a minimal level of agreement was achieved. That wasn't really a plan for how to go forward in a new way. And Chinese academics, many of whom I respect greatly, I think they're true experts, and a lot of them really do want to find ways to improve relations over the long term, just as I think the mainstream of the American academic community as well as the American governmental community wants. Ever since Dick Cheney was marginalized in the Bush administration, I think that the U.S. policy has been one very much to engage China. China is a responsible stakeholder. China is a good partner. How can we work together more fully? I'm sure there are problems and there's going to be distrust, but I think the U.S. position has been convergence. How to get the U.S. and China working more together. Whereas the Chinese position that I read over and over again last year and still going on is demonizing the United States on very many kinds of issues. The U.S. It goes back to U.S. history and the history of imperialism linked to hegemonism. It goes to the alliance system. I could go on and on. I've written about this, but I won't. I'll just summarize the present strategic thinking because I don't think it's really changed, despite the sort of cautionary tone that picked up in China, which gave more of an opportunity for the critics of this policy, whether those who accepted a broader approach to regionalism, those who said China isn't strong enough now, it has to wait for the next 20 years, emphasizing China's domestic problems, China's relative power of the United States versus that of China, the fact that China doesn't have partners that will work closely with it. All of these forces got more vocal, got more active, and said, let's reemphasize need for cooperation. But I don't think they are by any means the mainstream. I think the mainstream is yes, some delay is needed, whether it leadership change, whether it is China exposed its weakness somewhat last year, but also, China must continue to take advantage of situations like North Korean belligerence, which helps create the instability that a rising power can use to weaken the more established power. Pakistan-U.S. tensions, Russia-U.S. tensions, try to make sure those enable China to gain more space for its rise. So what does this say about some kind of long-term strategy for China for the future? I don't believe things are written in stone. I think there are frequent debates in China. The situation changes. It partly depends on China's relative power. It partly depends on U.S. policies, how they proceed. So that if you have an Obama-like leadership in the United States that prioritizes engagement and still would be very eager to work more closely with China on resolving problems, and if you have the Chinese position that prevailed a few years ago, reinforced, emphasizing the long-term strategy of China's rise, then there is a possibility for moving forward, and we should do everything we can to explore that possibility. I'm fully in support of engagement and against those who would demonize China the way I think that the U.S. has often been demonized. But I think that when you say what's happened in the last period with the South China Sea and the tensions, although there's been some improvement in the last month, what's happened with North Korea, and yesterday, of course, North Korea again launched a firing on South Korea. This time no one was hurt. What's happening with regard to Asian regionalism, and I think a lot of this is about what is the structure of the future of Asian regionalism. Is this going to be a kind of Asia-Pacific community, however much that term has really faded since Kevin Rudd used it, and it wasn't very timely and wasn't handled in a way that drew widespread support in ASEAN and certainly not in China. Is this, is the United States going to be strategic and careful in balancing, or will, if Obama's defeated and if the Tea Party types gain a lot more influence in international relations with their combination of isolationism and American arrogance and superiority, things could go downhill. But I think above all, China is the driving force in Asia. Its policies are the ones that set the tone for others. And if China wants reconciliation and overcoming the sorts of problems that emerge, such as it appeared China wanted in North Korea in 2006 to 2008, where there was an understanding between China and the United States would take a softer line, China would take a harder line. If that's the kind of thing that it wants, I think China will find a ready partner, and all of the middle powers right on the maritime border between China, between China and the United States, will welcome this ability to get along more and to resolve the problems, which aren't really serious in this region. There's no particular reason why they should be serious if we're working together, and the United States' priority remains how to deal with the security challenges from WMD proliferation and from terrorist-type activities. And the problems of the Middle East are huge. So I think the potential is there for working together. But I have to say that given what I've read, and I'm eager to be shown other sources and weigh them against what I concentrate on, I think there is a long-term strategy. And I think that strategy is Sinocentrism in Asia, with Asia as the predominant area. And that is how to weaken the U.S. alliances, how to get a more exclusive Asian regionalism, how to establish, of course, reunite with Korea, with Taiwan, but in a way that I think is likely to get more aggressive without provocations from Taiwan before too long. How to get the Korean Peninsula moving in a way that uses North Korea in a way to weaken South Korean ties with its neighbors and to shape an overall Korea that is heavily dependent on China and accepts the Sinocentric order that it did in the past. If the countries of the region do not work together to create an environment where they say, we want to engage China, We want to make sure the United States doesn't do anything rash. And if you get a Dick Cheney or something like that back in the United States, the U.S. allies, such as Australia, should say, we don't want that kind of provocation. We want you to be more active in engaging China. But also these countries have to say, if China's military budget is increasing at the rate it currently is, if China's military is lacking the transparency, if the battle is going to be intensifying for military superiority, intelligence competition, uncertainty about how economics may be used as clout for shaping security relations, then everybody would be wise to develop a regional community atmosphere that says to China, we're cooperating as much as we can with you, but if your behavior is provocative, then we are also doing the things that will ensure a higher likelihood of peace and stability in the region. And that begins with the Korean Peninsula, because I think North Korea is the most uncontrollable and most dangerous country that we face in the world. And if we can't get U.S.-Chinese cooperation on this obvious issue of North Korean belligerence, then I think the prospects for other types of cooperation aren't very high. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much. I will now call upon Professor Jia Qinghua to respond.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure and also a privilege to come here to speak in front of this distinguished audience. And also, it's a great pleasure to speak after Professor Roseman, whom I've known for many years. He's always provocative in thinking and also has a lot of insights. From him I have learned a lot. My job is to discuss his comments. And I got up at 4:15 this morning to catch the flight. And also not a few minutes ago I had a glass of wine. So if I say anything crazy, please forgive me. Does China have a grand strategy? Professor Roseman says, yes. But then a lot of Chinese are saying, no, we don't. Okay. It's like asking an American, does the Americans have a grand strategy? American says, what are you talking about? Okay. The Chinese say, you have a grand strategy, okay, of containment of China. And the Americans say, no, I wish our government is that smart. And of course, to the Chinese, most Chinese, they don't think China has a grand strategy. Okay. What are you talking about? Okay. Sino-centrism, is that a grand strategy? I don't know. If you look at the map, everybody has a bit of centrism, okay? Because if you look at the world map of different countries, they always put their country in the center, right? Even Australian map. They say down under, right? But then it's still the center, right? There is nothing wrong with, giving your own a better feeling about yourself by putting your country in the center of the world, because you look at the world from there, right? But then, other than Sino-centrism, what is China's grand strategy? I'm not sure. I think the Chinese government would like to claim that it has a grand strategy. Okay. And it has been very successful in implementing this grand strategy. Okay. Look at China, how much progress China has made over the years. Okay. Around 10% of growth for more than 30 years. We're very successful, right? So the Chinese government has been telling the Chinese people, we have a grand strategy. Okay. The Chinese people probably are half convinced, okay? Because they, if you look further, you know, Deng Xiaoping's approach is very different from Mao's approach. Okay? Whose grand strategy you are talking about? Okay. Mao had a grand strategy. Deng Xiaoping has a grand strategy, but they are so different. Okay. So we don't, at least we don't have a consistent grand strategy, right? The critics of the Chinese government, they have a lot of differences with the Chinese government, but on one thing they share the same view, that is, China has a grand strategy. Okay. Right? They think that China has a grand strategy, like the Chinese government would like to think that they have a grand strategy. Okay. But the problem is, in reality, probably China has many grand strategies because different people in China hold different visions about China. Okay. Some people think that China should do this, okay? Like in the South China, on the South China Sea question, some people in China argue, you know, we should follow the previous practice. Okay. We should not give up on the question of sovereignty, but at the same time we should shelf the differences with our neighbors and engage in cooperation in exploring the resources in the nearby waters. Okay. And this is the way to manage the problem and at the same time cultivate good relations with our neighbors. Okay. This is very important for China. Okay. China is still in the process of modernization and also reforms. China needs a peaceful international environment. Okay. And this is their grand strategy. Okay. Let's do it as we had done before, quite successfully. Okay. Until 2008, China's relationship with Southeast Asian countries could not be better. And then there are other people who think that they have grand strategy for China on the South China Sea. Okay. They think we had waited for such a long time. Okay. These islands belong to us, and they are occupying the islands. Okay. And they are exploring the resources at the expense of China, unilaterally. Okay. So it's time for us to do something about it. Otherwise we would lose these islands forever, and also we would lose the resources forever. Okay. So they have been pushing the Chinese government to take a tougher line on this. Okay. And there are also, you know, these people, they think in nationalistic terms. They think that, you know, we have been preaching to these countries for joint exploration of the resources. But what do we get in return? Okay. They work together with foreign oil companies to explore resources unilaterally. If we don't do anything like in response, you know, we are going to suffer tremendously. Our future generations will not going to tolerate us. Okay. So this is they have their grand strategy, okay, for that reason. So they want the Chinese government to take a tougher position, not only in the South China Sea, but also in the East China Sea with Japan. Okay. And there are also other people who have more parochial interests, okay, in China. They also think that China should not, you know, follow the previous line. in dealing with the South China Sea issues. Okay. People like officials in the Bureau administration in charge of the maritime affairs in China. Yeah. And the Hainan province, maybe Fujian province, the coastal provinces. Okay. They have their own interests of highlighting these issues because they want the government to allocate more resources so that they can have more equipments, more people, more funding, right? And even the Navy. You know? So different people have different grand strategies in China. Okay. On the North Korean issue, okay, I think Chinese are very much divided on how to deal with North Korea. Okay. China has three objectives in North Korea. Okay. One is that it should be nuclear free. Yeah. It should get rid of nuclear weapons because, I mean, possession of nuclear weapons on the part of North Korea would give incentive for Japan and South Korea to have nuclear weapons. Okay. That would lead to more nuclear weapon states around China. It's dangerous, right? And also, Kim Jong-il is not a very reliable person. Okay. You know it, you know, we also know it. Yeah. He's not a grateful person either. He doesn't tell us, you know, when he wants to shell somebody. Yeah. In the 50s, in 1950, China was dragged into the Korean War because Kim Jong-il, his father, yeah, started this war without China's prior agreement. China suffered the consequences. Part of the reason that we cannot, that Taiwan is still there, is because of the Korean War. After the Korean War, President Truman ordered the 7th Fleet to the Taiwan Strait. Okay. So we have a lot of grievances with our North Korean friends. Okay. The second objective in on Korea is no war, okay, for China. Yeah. I mean, the United States should not use force to deal with the problem. South Korea should not use force, and North Korea should not use force to address the problem, because if a war breaks out in the Korean Peninsula, this would have grave consequences for China. China is the neighbor. Right? One of the problems is the refugee problem. What are we going to do with those poor North Koreans? Yeah. The third objective is resolution of the problem through negotiation. Yeah. Yeah. So they have to talk to each other to solve the problem, yeah, to settle the problem. Yeah. China has been trying to push the two sides and also the concerned parties to sit down and to talk to each other to seek for a resolution. One of the problem is China is worried about the possible collapse of the North Korean regime because, you know, at least some people in China think that it is a cushion state. Right? So if the U.S. becomes hostile, it has to go through North Korea. I think it's old-fashioned thinking. Because nowadays they can just fly over, right? Instead of marching on foot, you know, like the Japanese used to do in the old days. Okay. But people still think along such lines. Okay. So people are very much divided as to how to respond to North Korea's perceived provocative actions. Okay. Last year. Yeah. last year, right? Actually, some people are very critical of the government's handling of the North Korean issue, thinking that it's being too soft on North Korea. Yeah. I think there might be other reasons for the Chinese government to be so tolerant of North Korea. Okay. One of the reasons is, you know, the relationship between China and the United States deteriorated. Okay. So, you don't want to do something that would alienate your North Korean friends, right? And also, another probably more important reason is that North Korea was in the process of succession. Okay. You want to make sure that the junior king is friendly, so that you have greater influence on him. Once the senior king passes away, last year there was a lot of rumors about the health of the King Jong Il. So if you are friendly, if you can be tolerant of North Korea, and then the junior king may be grateful. I don't know. I think that's part of the reasons. But anyway, on this issue, I don't think we have a grand strategy. We do this. It doesn't necessarily fit to our grand strategy. Okay. People have all kinds of thinking about North Korea. The Chinese government, even in the Chinese government, the different ministries have different views. Yeah. And also on the G2 thing, I don't think the Chinese government deliberately, rejected G2 because it thought that the United States was weak. Yeah. No. Rather for the opposite reason. That is, China was too weak. At least not strong enough to be there. Okay. And also China did not want to alienate its developing country friends. Okay. It's cold to be alone. I mean, high up there. Yeah, with the United States. Okay. China still thinks, many Chinese leaders still think that China is a developing country, even though a lot of people laugh at it. Okay. China is a developing country depending on where you look, whether China is a developing country. If you look at Shanghai, it's like a developed country. But if you look at, you know, the countryside, China is a developing country in many ways. Okay. And also China does not want to take up that many responsibilities. It doesn't have the resources. It doesn't have the ability, capacity to do it. Okay. China's rise has been so fast that China is not ready for it. Okay. Finally, about the future. Okay. I agree with Professor Rossman that the future is still fluid. Yeah. And also, it's very important for China and the United States to work together, okay, to help shape the world and to deal with various kinds of global issues. Yeah. For that to happen, I think both sides should liberate their minds and try to, learn how to deal with each other. Yeah. When Obama came into power, he thought, his administration did try. Okay. He made a lot of efforts. Unfortunately, okay, Chinese thought they were not enough. Okay. For example, he would like to meet Dalai Lama. But then he tries to be sensitive to China by choosing the right time and also the right place. Okay, not an official place. A time that he thinks that it's not sensitive to China. Okay. He thought that this is okay because every president in the past somehow saw Dalai Lama. You know. But China has risen to some extent. What was okay is not okay now. Okay. So he was very surprised that the Chinese reacted so strongly. And also weapon sales. Same story. Okay. He expected that what he did to take care of Chinese sensitivities was enough. Okay. But to the Chinese, this is not enough. Okay. And also China, on the Chinese side, we also have the same problem. Okay. China wants to be friendly to the United States. Okay. So it tries to help during the financial crisis and also on the Copenhagen, the climate change issue. Okay. From the Chinese perspective, China tried. Okay. But from the US perspective, China has risen so much, it's nowhere near enough. Okay. So both get very disappointed of each other. Okay. It's unfortunate. Okay. And now both have a bad taste of each other. Okay. But sooner or later they will realize they have to change their expectations, lower their expectations of the other side, and try to make more efforts on their respectively on their part. Okay. Until they can do that, okay, we'll have a problem of managing the most important bilateral relationship in this world. Okay. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I thought that was a really very interesting counterpoint to Professor Rosman's thesis. We've got some limited time for questions, and if you have any questions, could you please identify yourself and any organisation that you're from? Yes, gentleman there.
Thank you. Stephen Moon, I'm a member of the Institute. Thank you for both speakers. The statement that China wants to be friends with the United States, I'm just thinking, Obama recently, or fairly recently, said the greatest security threat to the United States is the potential for cyber warfare, and they've had a lot of attacks which I understand have essentially come from China. I would be very interested in hearing your comment, but from both speakers on this. Is one of the explanations that the military in China can't be controlled, or is it because, or is the explanation, yes, they can be, but perhaps China's not being as friendly as we all like to believe they potentially can be? Thank you.
Professor Rosman.
It is normal, of course, for major powers to engage heavily in intelligence activities, and a rising power like China has an opportunity to accelerate its rise by extending those intelligence activities beyond what other countries have done in the past, including industrial espionage as well as military espionage to catch up very quickly on weapons and stealing intellectual property rights. So we should be expecting a good deal of that, and that probably would be normal behavior. However, I think, and we still don't have all the contours of this, that this has gone beyond anything seen in modern times, presumably in history, because of the devices. I think there's a real sense of panic in the U.S. government and in various U.S. organizations, and probably in many other countries, about the degree to which this is occurring, which casts a shadow on many Chinese engage in other activities, as at times U.S. intelligence activity has cast a shadow on other Americans. But I think this has really become so unusual and so associated with what I still regard as the strategy for achieving comprehensive national power in the shortest possible time for advantages that I think aren't those of just a normal country, but really a country which gains dominance. So I think this cyber warfare is a subject now at the forefront of interest. And yet, I don't have enough detail, as I suspect most outside of the government don't have, on in both countries to be able to discuss it in depth.
Very briefly, I think Chinese government also thinks it is a victim of so-called cyber warfare, and also it's very hard to determine where, you know, it is launched. It may show in China, but then it may come from other, you know, routes. I don't know. I think this is probably an area that China and the United States should sit down and talk about, and how and to develop a way to manage this problem. It should not be in a way of developing a constructive relationship.
Yeah. Yes.
Kate Reed. I just wanted to go back to one of the things that was touched on the last question, and I'm interested in to what extent the PLA pulls strings in China relative to the central, the mainstream Communist Party, and whether or not they're the servant or master, and how the strategic policy is developed within China, what was the mechanism, and whether or not the PLA is sort of out on its own or a big faction. I just wanted your comment on that.
To understand the role of the PLA, you have to be aware of the structure of power in China. Okay? The PLA is under the leadership of the party. Okay? It doesn't belong to the state. Yeah. And also, under the leadership of the party, it means under the leadership of the general secretary of the party. Okay? Because other members are not supposed to manage military affairs. So PLA is supposed to be relatively independent or autonomous. But then if you only have one person taking care of the military from the party side, a lot of things goes unnoticed. Often you are asked to sign a you know, document. You don't look at the content because there are so many documents to be signed. And then the PLA assumed that you know as the party secretary. But then really you did not pay much attention to it, especially about the implications of that kind of development, decision. Okay. For example, the experiment of, test flight of J-20, yeah, the Chinese jet fighter. Okay, I assume that President Hu Jintao, approved the test flight, but he did not pay attention to the date of the test flight and its implications of that kind of timing. Okay. And that's the time when Secretary of Defense Gates came to visit China. Okay, yeah. So it became politically sensitive. But then the Ministry of Foreign Affairs did not know this. Okay, so they beforehand could not counsel President Hu that this is a bad date. The PLA decided on the date not because of its impact on Gates' visit. It's for a number of reasons, including the weather conditions. Okay, so when Secretary Gates came to China, he became very upset. Okay, so he asked who, why, who appeared apparently did not know very much about about it. He couldn't recall, so he talked to the defense minister. So that explained why, you know, how some of the problems occurred. But then I think the military is still under the control of the civilians. And when the party secretary really wants to get something done, the military is still, still under the leadership. So I don't see an independent, deliberate, you know, design on the part of the military to push for their own agenda, okay, other than demanding for more money, like military in other countries.
I will respond briefly, and I appreciate what was just said and agree with it on the whole, except at the end. It seemed to me the main incidents last year were incidents where the PLA was involved in taking a position which contradicted the position of the mainly the Chinese academic community a couple of years earlier. How are we going to deal with North Korea? How are we going to deal with tensions in the East China Sea or the South China Sea, and in U.S. relations? And in each case, we also saw the writings from the PLA and the journals associated with it stressing the negative side, the demonizing the United States, the negative side of the cooperation. And so do we weigh those more heavily than we do the academic experts? Who really has power? And since the PLA isn't really under the control of hardly anyone, and even when the top leader is trying to solidify power, it's not clear that he doesn't need the PLA more than the PLA needs the leader. So there's a lot of uncertainty, a lack of transparency about that. And I think that's one of the confusions outside of the country. And I don't think really Chinese academics clear that up very much often, and they don't certainly can't write about it. Nobody's writing, these are the concerns about what the PLA is doing. They simply have to accept that and write around it. And that's one of the problems for us.
This gentleman here.
Cyril Goldberg, No Association. To what extent do you think that the demonization, perceived demonization by China of America might be aimed more internally, saying, look at the danger out there, we have to have solidarity here and don't sort of rock the boat as far as the in China, you know, the party's in charge and stay with it.
I think what is written about the demonizing characters, particularly for internal audiences, creating an image, but it does have a compounding effect. And one of the lines of that argument is basically, and I'm not saying this is the mainstream, but it is pretty popular, that Western civilization has done harm to the world. It produced two centuries of imperialism, racism, injustice in the world. China was humiliated. And now it's time for the rise of Eastern civilization. And this is a kind of a rejection of the world system that I think goes beyond what the Soviet Union was doing in the Cold War period. And although no one's confronting it and saying this kind of argument is dangerous. I haven't seen nothing in Chinese that says this is a bad sort of argument. So this is the kind of one-sided debate in a country that relies heavily on censorship and where a lot of people are writing not just because of the diversity of views, but because of the advantages of parroting a line that's coming down from the top to some degree. And so I'd say this demonization is also convenient for a notion that China can convince others in the world, in parts of the world at least, that it is standing up to the United States. So it's not entirely just an internal message.
Well, I don't I agree that sometimes you want to find a often you want to find a scapegoat for political reasons. For example, the relationship between China and the United States, with China and Southeast Asian neighbors, deteriorated last year. You know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has to explain to this, has to explain this to the Chinese people, right? They can't say, you know, I messed things up, you know, right? Ministry, I mean, the officials don't say that they made a mistake. Okay? Mm-hmm. How do they say it? They say it's because of the United States' return to Asia. Okay? You know, this is the strategy you often take, you know, in all countries. The officials try to divert people's attention abroad in order to maintain some kind of political correctness. Yeah. And also, I think the Chinese military, like other countries' military, tend to take a worst-case scenario view. Okay. It's their job. Okay. So if they take a more hawkish view than the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and or academics, I mean, it's not that unique. Okay. The U.S. Defense Department has a very different view on China from the State Department during the Bush administration. Okay. The State Department became so frustrated with the Defense Department. Okay. Why? Because they have different job. So they tend to see the world differently. It's up to the leadership to coordinate the views and to get some kind of middle ground policy. So I wouldn't be that surprised that the PLA tend to have a more negative view, a more pessimistic view about international situation and about the United States, China's relationship with the United States.
Yes.
Patrick Moore, I'm a member of the Institute. Thank you. Thank you both very much. It's nice to see that both China and America having similar global strategies, both in investment, in terms of influence throughout the world, and it seems to be that it's not geographic, that they want to have more land area. They want extended influence through investment, through politics. But in this strategy, you have to also think about India. The word India was not mentioned this evening, and yet in the longer run, India has to be, I think, included in the thinking.
Well, the way you just summarized the difference between China and the United States, I think, sounded like a healthy competition, and to that degree it is. Both countries trying to win influence and gain more countries that support it, and that is the way things will go if things are moving along in a positive direction in that regard. Now, India is a significant country, and I think that there's been an effort in the United States since the end of the Clinton administration and continuing today to strengthen U.S. ties with India, and with some success and some difficulty. China has had pretty bad relations with India over most of the last 50 years since they fought a war. China, however, has used economic ties to strengthen ties with India considerably, and the two are now very much improving economic partners, and I think that's healthy for everybody concerned. But if you look at countries that China has demonized for foreign policy and warned about getting closer to Japan, Australia, the United States, activities in Southeast Asia, India is very high on the list. There's been a lot of writings about Indian hegemonism and what China has done towards India's neighbors and towards the territorial dispute and towards other issues has been building up its military in the Indian border has been a considerable concern for India. So I do think talking about this triangle is a very useful and increasingly important subject. There are a variety of other triangles we haven't spent much time on, but this in particular is one I'm glad you pointed attention to.
Very briefly, I agree that you know the relationship with between China, India, and U.S. India has become more important. India is a rising power. I want to add that China-India relationship have somewhat improved over the years. That both countries have agreed to develop some confident building measures along the border. Both sides withdraw troops to some and try to communicate with each other. On major troop movements. And of course, economic ties have developed, when we conceive the trilateral relationship, we tend to think that China and the United States are taking the initiatives, and the Indians are passive receivers. No, that's not true. Indians are very smart. They have their own agenda to promote their influence and international status and to get the best out of this. It's completely understandable, and they are very successful in doing it.
I see that there are still a number of questions, but I'm sorry, we are going to have to call the session to an end. China's grand strategy, past, present, and future. Does China have a grand strategy? I don't know. But we've got two very, very interesting presentations which have given us a lot of food for thought. As far as China is, as I mentioned earlier on, thinking about China is something that has become very much a growth industry in Australia, not just over the last week, but over the last decade. And clearly, Australia's future, Australia's future is intimately linked with developments in China. And we certainly have to have the capacity to answer questions like whether China has a grand strategy. If it has a grand strategy, what is it? If it doesn't have a grand strategy, why doesn't it? But if it's whatever its policies are, they better be good for us. I would like to thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. It's been a really stimulating and informative presentation. Thank you very much.